to October. I can't decide that already doing the two peas in a podcast in October means that the year has flown by, or is the year crawling by? I'm not sure. I haven't decided quite yet.
Yeah, well, it's Trevor here. Hi, Michelle. I used to wait until 30th of October to plant the summer crops up in the Adelaide Hills where I lived for 30 years. So the 30th of October I knew well as the date in which the frost had finished, the only safe date, and it wasn't really safe because once there was a frost in December up there, but it's been a very, very cold and wet year. So I think a lot of people have been inside potting, and potting is a big pastime for, well, both the commercial world and gardening and the private world of gardening. People have gardens that consist mainly of pots. I mean, yeah. It is because they can control it, you know. They can control the soil, control the weeds, control the sunlight, they can move them about and that. So we have been spending a lot of time, both my wife and I, potting things up, taking cuttings and that, like.
You can do that lovely stratosphere still with pots, can't you? Like, you can have a large pot and have them in ascending order, and even if you've got a small space, you can almost still have those lovely,
yeah,
you know, stories. The old days of just having one pot in one spot are well and truly. People have gone potty for pots, Trevor.
There are geniuses at it. They do, of course, get the soil right. Perlite's an in thing for making the pots light as well as well draining. So there are a massive collection of indoor pots too. People who have got skylights and what have you start displaying almost internal gardens,
yeah,
of pot plants. And if you have got an atrium or a courtyard, well, quite often you have big pots and you just put them on wheels and you move them outside and then back inside to look when they're looking good again. So the idea of pots over winter is obviously very big in Europe. You know, yeah, a lot of our ideas come from Europe, but where the world is snow-covered, you spend a lot of time in your hothouse, and it's probably a heated hothouse as well. Because,
yeah, I guess it would be, wouldn't it?
Well, if it's minus 10 outside, you're going to get a lot of condensation on your window. We had condensation on our windows this morning.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't look.
No, well, you're urban.
I mean, yeah, I'm a bit more urban than you are.
So we have been taking a lot of cuttings of fig trees, of buddleias, of those tall artemisias that someone's growing too close to the roadside, down the road a bit. And grapevines, wallflowers. And, of course, it's a good idea if it's this cold late in the season, the pests have had a bit of a chance to build themselves up. So you also are growing things inside and wait until it gets hot so the plants can grow fast,
yeah,
in order to avoid not being eaten by the first night of insect food lovers. So I think that it's a very good idea to have yourself a hothouse or have yourself a spot where you can pot, because there will be a time each year where that's where you'll gravitate to because you just don't want to get your hands and your feet cold out in the weather.
I recently had the whole, well, it'd be a year ago now, wouldn't it, where the back of the house I had all sliding doors, all glass sliding doors.
Yeah.
Well, what's been really lovely there is I've been putting just little tables, like, so, you know, with the tomatoes, and I wasn't quite ready to put them in the garden yet.
Mm.
So just line them up by that window. So I'm like, oh, I've got my own little back room hothouse, which has been really nice, actually.
Yeah, well, that's all it takes. It only, because you can bring these things inside, they look alive inside. They're like having flower arrangements too. You bring flowers inside and it feels alive.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's nothing wrong with putting even the edibles inside because they are breathing out oxygen, breathing in carbon dioxide and doing a lot of good.
They are.
So if I run out of potting soil, I blame my wife, as I blame her for everything. And we must have got through a dozen 20 to 30 litre bags of potting mixture.
Oh my gosh.
And that was trying to use as little as possible because we also used our compost heap down the bottom, and we also use other things like just polystyrene, old sort of swimming pool spaghetti and stuff like that to lift it up a bit and get a bit of drainage in the bottom. So we used as little as possible, but we did so much this year because basically from about May through to the, well, today, the end of October, has all been winter and rain, and we've had massive rainfall, well and truly over 600 mil because I've been recording it. So we got above average rainfall and we're really only 3/4 of the way through the year.
Yeah.
We've got more coming.
I had my rainwater tanks replaced from the fire. They put them in the wrong spot. Got home from work and, like, you put the rainwater tanks in the wrong spot. And they said, all right, we'll come out and move them to the right spot. So then they messaged me 2 weeks ago, and the tanks have been there for 2 months or whatever, and they said, oh, we'll move them. And I said, what are you going to do with the water in them? I will just let that rush out. I'm like, no, I don't think so. So I leave them where they are. This has been the best winter I can ever remember at all. I just had this horrifying view of all this water getting just lost. I'm like, no. I said, I'll buy another tank. You can plumb that in.
Yeah, well, the matter of building as well as gardening, the two are very combined in that way. We have a big tank, one of the few things we did right, and it was overflowing.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. I went to lunch one day, two or three weeks ago, and I was asked by a first-time gardener, how do you get rid of this pest off the climber that she was wanted me to. I was about to answer and I realised, well, a first-time gardener, what I'm about to tell her is how to kill things.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, we've changed since that time. I mean, when I was brought up, yeah, people did tend to really blanket spray everything and get rid of everything and think that NPK was enough, you know. And so I stopped advising her how to get rid of the pest. And I sort of said, well, look, after 50 years of gardening, I've come to realise that the nature in garden is as good as the plants in garden. So the things that are living within your garden are just as interesting as the plants, really.
Oh,
so
absolutely. I mean, I've got very prolific garden at the moment in both weeds and plants, though. And that's the funny thing. And my buddleias, my lavender, my nasturtiums, the borage, like everything's going great guns. The fruit trees I've got, but the muntree has just gone berserk, you know. And my and then I was sort of like, I was weeding around some of the more vulnerable plants, I suppose. But like I was saying to Nita over lunch today, but then I suddenly realised that I've got much more wildlife than I've ever had. So I'm suddenly a little bit loath to be too pedantic about clearing out all the weeds, because clearly they're having a big part to play in having, I've got that many butterflies. I mean, I've got bees galore, which is just what makes me so happy.
Yep.
But so many butterflies and bugs and your little hoverflies and yeah.
That's precisely the message. In that I started to think to myself, well, first time gardener, you don't want to tell them about death, you want to tell them about life, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
And so that person, I mean, they might have impoverished soil and have no chance in the first year of getting a successful garden, even if they do fertilise it, because it's just all sand or something like that, or it's down by the beach. So probably the best advice is to tell them to grow what you were describing there, that is your borage and your comfreys and all your marigolds and all your flowering buddleias and whatnot, in order to get a garden where you don't worry about losing anything. You know, put in cereal, put in barley, put in wheat, put in that famous one, mustard. You know, you put it in, it grows like crazy.
Yeah, I've got
and you don't have any intention of eating that much mustard leaf.
Yeah.
Or the other one, what's a rocket? Put in something that grows really well no matter where you are, or nasturtiums or whatever, and just let it grow for the first year and just sit and watch for the first year the life come to your garden. Because if you put a water bowl there, and maybe your scraps or a bit of bread or something like that, you'll see the birds come too, and you'll see that overnight all the night creatures, you know, all the centipedes and the various nighttime garden crawlers, which are basically your earwigs, but also a lot of other cockroaches and caterpillars live at night there. You'll see that everything you put out is gone and the life is coming to your place. That's what you want.
That's exactly what you want.
And then just sacrifice the crop, just turn it into the ground and let it rot for a while. And then when you see all this life in your garden, you'll get life easily enough yourself, you know, because it's no use putting in, I mean, you could advise people spray with agricultural oil or put soapy water over them, or you could describe the various good ways of getting rid of things, you know, the Deris dusk and the neem oil and stuff like that. But it's still the wrong attitude to begin with, you know. You get life there first, and with an abundance of life, well, then you start to lose bits of everything. You lose bits of your crop, but you also lose bits of your pests because the other predators are coming. So I think that's an important message, and also it's a modern message, because we were told after World War II that everything gets wiped out, you know. It's like being in an operational theatre. We can't, because the subject is vulnerable, we got to kill everything in the theatre in order to operate on him or her, you know. That was the sort of thinking. Well, it's gone the opposite way of that now. Now people are thinking, well, life itself is in abundance and it's strong.
Yeah.
And you're part of it, you know. You're not there as the only gardener. There's millions of gardeners who are working with you because they're all the creatures in the soil and there's supposed to be billions of them. Now, there's thousands of different types of nematodes and cutworms and that fungus. You know, there's so many things in the ground that really they're all gardening too.
Oh, and the more, yeah, exactly. Like, it's this great big symbiotic relationship. And just, yeah, while you're gardening, it's just nothing more joyful than seeing, I don't know, like visitors who hang around because they love what you've created. Sort of thing, yeah, and then the soil and the worms and the everything. And it is a bit of letting go of that headset that your garden has to look perfect and beautiful. I mean, we talked about Zen gardens a couple of months ago, and they are gorgeous, but on the bigger scale of things, I think we have to really let go of the fact that the backyard or the home garden has to be this perfectly manicured, sculptured thing, because by doing that, not only are you causing yourself a lot of stress because it becomes work, but you are, you're just getting rid of all the things that are actually going to increase. I mean, we've had so many more bees this year, and I'm sure it's because I'm just leaving some of the stuff. And my fruit trees have never had given me so much fruit.
Yep.
You know, that's not, it's not rocket science. But I think if I'd cut back way too much, I wouldn't have had all that.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're right. And actually, there is this, well, famous landscaper called Peter Udo. A Dutch man, as it turns out.
Naturally, he will be fabulous.
And he's coming up with what he calls perennial natural. He's probably the most famous landscaper in the world today. He's listed amongst 100 most creative people in the world today because he's come up with a system of landscaping in which things are planted in waves. If you look at the plan, that is, you get an aerial view down on it, the blocks of planting are all sort of divided up like you divide up a cake into slices, and each one of those slices is made up of high and low plants and medium plants, blue and purple and red plants. They're a mixture of colour and size and texture and type, you see. And each one of those waves comes down into the, well, the pathway, the walkway. And these are urban gardens because they've discovered that cities are a heat sink and that they need about four times more vegetation than they've got because the vegetation itself is a way of cooling the cities down, you know, and also providing shade for the people, colour and mental stability for the people. It does appear as though people must have that retreat to nature in order to stay sane. Because,
oh, gosh, yeah.
So in many places in America and Canada and England and Europe, he's put up these new age gardens that are natural looking. He calls them emotional artistic gardens, and that he's the only one designing like it. It is pretty difficult to design in these waves of colour and height. But they're a big, big change from the English gardens, which have been the implanted orthodoxy of Australian gardening, you know. So the English came over here and they told us about how we could have mazes and we could have walks and borders and little outdoor rooms and stuff. And it was transplanted from England and it was the world's best at the time because those English gardens were the best. But it's changed sufficiently now that whilst that was the best attempt at nature then, now there is this new wave of people with nature, and they're doing what you're saying, and that they're letting it go. I mean, here's perennial natural gardens. They actually go to seed and they turn brown over winter, and then the snow comes on those northern hemisphere places and he leaves them there and they set the seed and next year they come up too. Well, he does maintain them.
Yeah, it's so sensible. But to me, this kind of, also we all need to remember that's when you should be resting anyway.
Yep.
Why fight a garden during winter, especially in the Northern Hemisphere? We can see ourselves, what you're saying, like it's been so wet here. Why fight a garden? Yep. Why work with it?
Yeah, why not just relax and take your time? And the other thing he does is he has a very wide footpath, big enough for four people and three bikes. So it's a wide footpath, but that's all he has. If you look at a lot of urban landscaping at plazas and piazzas, and they're all paved and they're seated, but he's got this mixture of trees, mixture of plants, and they tend to survive well amongst each other, whereas if you just have one type of plant, it's fairly monoculturist. So
yeah.
He's introduced the polyculture into the urban landscape, and he's just got people walking by. And he's got these waves of colour and height, and you actually see it through the height. So you walk past some areas of height and you see the garden in the distance, and that actually is the exact opposite of what we saw. Well, both you and I, well, you and I both visited Carrick Hill, which is a magnificent stone manor house.
Yeah.
And it's got the gardening of the English there, and it's got retaining walls and the height at the back and the small stuff in front and the medium stuff in between, and it's all colourful. It's very, very beautiful garden, but it's also fairly, well, they would have thought of it as being an attempt at nature, because you cannot get nature. You can get Peter Udoff's version of nature, which he calls emotional and artistic, but it's still a version of nature that isn't true nature.
Yeah.
You know? And those English gardens, I also went and saw Anlaby, which is by Udunda, and that was a, I really love being there in that it's a reminder of Australia's pioneering history. And you could see that it was so isolated back in the early 1850s that any passerby would have called in, because, you know, that's, that had supplies of water and meat and various other things like horse foods and horseshoes, and it had all of it. It was like a village.
Yeah.
It was an actual manor house, but it had so many outbuildings like shearing sheds and stables and blacksmith shops and various other guest rooms, and I don't know what half the buildings were, but there were a lot of them. So you'd walk in, or you'd drive your horse in, and you'd think, well, I've just arrived at a village.
I was going to say, it's got that real village thing to it, hasn't it? Where you're just sort of like, oh, this must be some village I've happened upon, and then you realise it's like not. I suppose it would have had to have been back then, wouldn't it?
Well, it had its own roads and stuff, so it was very much like a village of today. So it is nice having history frozen, but it's also, it's a mistake. You should not try and implant things from the Northern Hemisphere down here. I mean, you have to in a way, because they've used our eucalypts up there, and, you know, everyone exchanges things. But it's nice to see this new idea of nature coming just at a time that we're beginning to appreciate our native plants more.
And just the fact that there's so many, even the, you know, the Australian TV shows are featuring so many more of those plants, because the thing is, it's so successful. And the idea being, I think the older idea was that you couldn't kind of create that sort of sculptured garden. You don't want a sculptured garden, but you can still have lots of different range of colour and size and texture and shape and all that sort of stuff as well with a lot of our indigenous plants, and they survive just a little bit better.
Well, they are very good at surviving. Now, there are the woolly bushes and the various sort of herbal bushes. There are a lot of Australian natives that have been sort of cultivated, you know what I mean? Because, like I say, you cannot have real nature. If you just put up a wild gum tree forest, it will burn and you're in strife. So you got to accept that nature, in whatever way it occurs, is not going to be the way it would have occurred without you, because you're introducing water, you're introducing variety, you're doing things that the nature never would have managed on its own. But I think you can still do what Peter Udoff does, and that is use your imagination and your artistic sense and get the whole of nature and life back into the garden and into the soil whilst you're doing these other things. You don't really just have to interpret everything in the way that the English would like to, because I think really they came out here as pioneers to get rich and go back home.
I think they had a bit of longevity.
Yeah, they didn't really love the place, and we who were born here are much greater love, I think.
I think you're right. No, that's true. And also, it's still good to go visit some of these places and things like that to remind yourself of what can happen if you've got a team of gardeners on your hands.
Well, he does rely fairly good on self-seeding, you see. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So if you can try, and even when you're doing mopping and dropping, leave a few things that you discover on the way. Basically, we've got perennial ryegrass and wild oats. So they're the two main introduced weeds that we're getting, but they're luscious weeds and they make really good compost. So you can rip them out fairly easily too when the soil's wet. But if you discover other things on your way, just leave them there and come back to them later if you don't know what they are originally. and see what they are, because self-seeding is a very valuable device. And
well, I nearly pulled out comfrey too early.
So did I.
Yeah, and then I was just like, oh, what? And then I thought, well, hang on, I'm just going to leave it because it doesn't look quite like something, you know, it was in the veggie patch, and I've got the most gorgeous comfrey now. It's just purple. It's just beautiful. So thank goodness
flowering
I left it.
Flowering purple.
Yeah. And that would have self-seeded from last year.
Oh, yeah, they die off and disappear.
Yeah, and then
they come up again because their roots are so deep.
Yeah, fabulous. And it looks beautiful through the garden. I love comfrey, actually.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I thought we could talk about is, well, I'm getting 7 eggs a day now.
Uh-huh.
The crows were getting them all, but then then my wife came home, and all during the school holidays we were out there working, and that scared the crows away because they couldn't get, and we got 7 eggs suddenly. Also, the winter crops have come on at the same time, so broad beans, globe artichokes, spuds, strawberries, spinach and peas, they're all there. All the crops you planted months and months ago and now all got the fruit on them, and some of them have gone to seed. The broccoli and cabbages and all that have gone to seed, but there's a lot producing. So it is time, too, to cook with that stuff.
Just as a point of interest, I saw some broccoli seedlings in a supermarket the other day. They were selling broccoli seedlings. I thought, oh, God, this is just a bit late for that. I know. I just had a bit of a giggle, and then I felt like standing there next to the stand saying to people, please do not waste your time. Yeah. But it's a bit of that mentality of we've still got to eat seasonally, and we want our broccoli in the middle of summer, and that's not a possibility. Whereas
there is a possibility that there is a summer broccoli. I don't know of any, but there could be a summer broccoli.
No, it was the green dragon, you know, the traditional one.
Yeah.
Broccolini. But look, why would you want things out of season when whatever's in season, there's so much of it. It's so fabulous. I just had some of Trevor's strawberries. I don't buy shop strawberries. I hate them. But they're beautiful. Mine, I've got 8 planted. They should be. I should go home and check them now. I think I haven't looked for a week.
Put a bit of seaweed on them. They always love seaweed.
Yeah, I've got to go double check. Yeah, and then there's spinach and the cooking. Baking. What are you baking with your eggs, Trevor?
Well, I'm doing spinach triangles.
Yum.
And there's a good recipe on YouTube where you don't even cook the spinach first, so you just put in your ricotta cheese and your feta cheese, and then you chop up your spinach or your silver beet, and you put them in your mixing, and it mixes everything up together. So you put in parsley and mint and the other ingredients, I've forgotten what they are, but you don't have to cook the spinach first, you just chop it up and you put it in there raw, and then the Kenwood mixer will mix it all so it comes out as a mixture. Because the ricotta cheese is pretty good at holding it all together, of course. And then you just get fresh phyllo. Because we've now got a local shop just down the road. You can go and get a heap of phyllo. You cut the roll, which is about 300 mil long. You can cut it in 100 mil lots. And then unwrap it and then just roll up these things in. And too much butter, I know. You put butter between the phyllo and then you put butter on top to get it brown. But there you go. I'll make about 2 dozen, and a sitting, and that actually is a hot. You know how you said you were going to do something with broad beans, and you're going to eat it all week.
Yeah.
Well, once you make 2 dozen spinach triangles, you could eat them all week.
Yeah, just for lunch, bring them to lunch. Yum.
You can tell us how to make that broad bean thing.
Well, I think I've told people before, but I'm going to tell them again. So you just get the broad beans, and you don't have to steam them, but I do just lightly. So you steam them lightly, and then you mortar and pestle heaps of mint, olive oil,
garlic.
You've always got to have garlic.
Butter.
But no, not butter, just olive oil. And then you sort of smash that all together and into like almost like a paste, like a pesto style paste.
Yeah.
And then you just make sourdough bread. Yeah. Sourdough bread, sprinkle some feta on top. Oh, gourmet lunch. Everyone will be jealous of me next week at work.
You spread that onto the bread.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you toast your bread and you take that.
Well, you don't actually cook it at all. It's just a beaten up paste.
Yep. You can steam the broad beans slightly. Mm. I do. I like them, but I know the original recipe you don't, but I do.
Mm.
And then you just pile it on top of your sourdough bread, sprinkle it with feta. Yum. A little bit more olive oil just to add to your health. It's good for the heart, Trevor.
We got two different sorts of olive oil. Yes, well, peas. We got the biggest peas we've ever had because of this rainfall. And, I mean, we've got snow peas that you actually pot because you can't eat them raw, but they're very big. And the peas inside of them are very big. So I suppose my favourite with the peas really is the peanut sauce.
The satays with the
With the satay and that. So that's, my wife is more inventive and got a lot more recipes. You can just do a cheese sauce on all these greens too.
Oh, yum, yum. Mm. I just love getting them. I steam them with a whole bunch of herbs. Like, I'll get spinach and beans and even your broad beans, put them in a steamer. Steamers are all the rage at the moment now. You can get these separate steamer things. Steam it, put some feta on top of it if you can't be bothered making a cheese sauce, and then just eat all this steamed stuff. Or my other favourite is that you steam them, or then you lightly toss them through some soy sauce and garlic. Yum. A little bit of an Asian green side. Yummo.
Yes, well, of course, I'm also harvesting spuds, and there's nothing you can't do with it.
No, nothing you can't do with spuds.
Certainly all those peas and beans go down very well, and the spinach go down very well with mashed potatoes.
Yeah, yum. Mm. Yeah,
and you can make patties too. And if you're like us and you've got red kidney beans and that sort of thing in the freezer, well, then you can make patties out of a lot of these things, because it actually becomes bubble and squeak leftovers after a while too.
Yum, which is the best.
Yes.
Which is the best. So anyway, we're going to wrap it up a little bit now, Trevor. So what are we going to talk about next month?
Well, I mean, this is the middle month of spring. It's the last month of spring. I'm still planting melon and beans. I know I haven't got enough garlic in, so we can just do our usual thing. And normally in a month, I find some interesting topic.
And I find I'm happy to listen to it. So it'll be November. We'll be closest to Christmas. We talk about what everyone can have ready for Christmas.
Yeah, lunch. Well, those eggs will come in handy.
Yeah, tell me about
Christmas
it.
Christmas cakes and fruit cakes and stuff are coming up, aren't they?
Yeah, I've got a family function next month, and Trevor's been giving me eggs, so I'm thinking some frittata would be nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. All right.
Okay.
So there's been lots to ponder. Lots to ponder this month.
Okay.
We're warming up. It's October. We're warming up and we're thinking of more things.
Yeah.
We're thinking of more things. And just as a reminder to people too, in December, on December the 3rd, we are having a quiz night to raise some funds, and that'll be at the Gawler District College at the Phoenix House. $10 a ticket if you can get a table of eight, or even if you can't, just however many, come along. If you look on our website and you can book the tickets or ring Jeanette, they'll be on the 3rd of December.
Just bring along your hidden encyclopedia. They ask some pretty tough questions.
They do ask some pretty well. I don't know. I don't think we've won yet, have we, Trevor? It's just like, not good. It's not good. All right. So we'll see you next month.
Yep, see you later.